You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at kind of an unusual summer movie season with Reggie the Real Critic.
First, there's a lot of excitement in Wisconsin right now over the plans for Taiwanese electronics manufacturer Foxconn to build a plant in the state.
There are also a lot of questions surrounding the future plant in southeastern Wisconsin, including possible environmental consequences. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the plant's potential impact on the Great Lakes Water Compact. Now, WisConText has released a new report on the environmental effects of some byproducts of liquid crystal display or LCD screen manufacturing.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of WisContext.org. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What parts of LCD display manufacturing cause the most alarm for environmentalists?
Well, probably the big distinction to be made here is that actually fabricating the liquid crystal display components poses a lot more environmental problems than assembling the finished product. So if you're an operation where you're just kind of putting together the final pieces into a monitor or television or what have you, then that operation is going to probably create less resource use and fewer kind of chemical release problems than where you're actually kind of doing the raw materials.
And do we know exactly yet what kind of plant this will be for Foxconn?
Well, every indication is that it's going to involve fabrication. I believe in the paperwork for it, they've been referring to it as Fab 818. They've been using the language fabrication in a lot of the materials that they've put out. So it's pretty safe to conclude that they're planning on actually fabricating some of the components. So what extent is not clear.
The electronics manufacturing industry obviously has been around for a long time. What kind of environmental advances has the industry made?
Well, over time, it has managed to eliminate, some dangerous components, or at least, cut down on them significantly. One example that, someone talked with me about in my reporting was the use of lead solder, to hold things together, and how the industry made a concerted effort to cut down on that. Of course, lead, very toxic element that built up in the body, and that creates a lot of concerns for long-term health impacts. So, there is a capacity there to get better at some things, but obviously, still a whole lot of other things that pose a range of problems.
And what do we know about Foxconn in particular, their track record on environmental hazards with their plants?
Well, we know that they've been accused of a lot of things that either, endanger the environment around the factories or endanger their workers. There have been accusations that they dumped heavy metals into rivers neighboring their factories in China. There have been accusations that their use of benzene caused workers to get sick. Of course, benzene is a known carcinogen, but they've claimed that there wasn't really a link between the benzene and their workers who got leukemia. But obviously, it's well established that that's a dangerous substance.
Well, you mentioned benzene, so let's get into some of the more common byproducts of electronics manufacturing. What role does benzene play in LCD component manufacturing?
Well, benzene is an organic solvent, and most frequently it's used to clean things at various stages of manufacturing. Keeping things clean is really important when you're fabricating any kind of electronic equipment, whether that's an LCD screen or a computer chip. And there's, obviously many very fine and tiny layers and components that have to go together, and you want to keep them all pretty pristine so it'll all function when you put it together. And benzene, along with a lot of water, is something that can be used to do that.
Another element that's used is copper. It's certainly a very common metal. What kind of health concerns are there related to copper?
Well, copper is, out there naturally in the environment. It's something that all living beings actually, use, all mammals and plants, I should say. But being exposed to too much of it can obviously create health concerns. And it's, one of many heavy metals that might be involved in manufacturing these products. Depending on the specifics, there are a lot of these substances used.
And what happens to the waste materials after the copper is used up in the process?
So basically what we've been told from people who study these things is that they're sort of boiled down into kind of a liquid sludge and, you know, stored in containers, barrels, and these containers have can leak sometimes. It's not clear that that's inevitably going to happen, obviously, in the case of a Wisconsin Foxconn plant. But we've kind of yet to see any specifics about what kind of waste products they anticipate or how they plan to deal with those things.
We're talking right now with Scott Gordon. He's associate editor of WiskContext.org, and he's bringing us up to date on some of the environmental concerns that could come into play with the proposed Foxconn plant that is looking at southeastern Wisconsin for a location. Scott, another component element is fluorine. What role does that play in this kind of manufacturing?
Well, fluorine can be used for a few different things, including cleaning or kind of treating surfaces to make them, you know, water resistant or fingerprint resistant or just kind of generally more durable. Mm-hmm. And the issue with that is that it's usually obtained from a gas called nitrogen trifluoride. You know, just pure fluorine by itself can be very dangerous to work with. So what factories that use it tend to do is bring in a different gas that contains fluorine molecules, you know, and use a process to separate out those molecules and, you know, and get what they need. And nitrogen trifluoride itself is a greenhouse gas, and there aren't huge amounts of it present in the atmosphere. You know, fluorine-containing gases are a really small percentage of the greenhouse gases out there. But there has been some concern about the electronic industry's use of it, and that if it's not reined in somehow, then this could gradually over time become a greater contributor to global warming.
Well, because you were saying it's not present in large amounts, but we're certainly going in a more and more electronics direction with everything in our lives. So it could multiply, it sounds like.
Right. And, you know, I've talked to a couple of people who've done a lot of research on this, and what they basically said is, you know, there's not a huge reason to be alarmed about fluorine right now, but we also shouldn't be dismissive about the possible issues it could cause down the line.
And finally, the last component that you looked at is indium tin oxide. How is that used for making LCD screens?
Well, indium tin oxide, again, has a few different roles, but, you know, for example, coating a touch screen is one thing that that is commonly used for. And The question of indium sort of points to a broader environmental concern in manufacturing electronics, and that's that, you know, it's not just about the potential hazards to the surrounding environment or to workers. It's also about how you're using up resources across the world. And, you know, indium is considered a relatively scarce metal. It's not necessarily super rare, but it's kind of an increasingly coveted thing in electronics manufacturing. So there's a little bit of concern out there about just the sustainability of that resource. You know, if people are going to be able to responsibly manage what's still there to be mined, if people are going to be able to effectively recycle things that have already been used from discarded products.
At this point, how much do we know about what the potential environmental impact of the Foxconn plant in Wisconsin might be?
Well, the thing is that we really don't, because they haven't laid out a whole lot of details about exactly what they want to do or exactly what the, you know, environmental impacts they anticipate will be. And of course, we might not hear a whole lot about that because, you know, one of the things in the incentives bill in the legislature right now is that they wouldn't have to do an environmental impact statement before breaking ground on a factory.
So they don't have to present any kind of plan for how they would dispose of or how they would safely use materials that they might be using?
I mean, there are other, you know, processes, especially under federal regulations, where I'm sure they would have to provide some of that information. But the kind of environmental impact statement is one upfront way to do it that also would involve public hearings and so forth that would give people more of an opportunity to learn about this stuff and comment on it. The reason that we kind of went about the story the way we did is to kind of take a survey of what's out there in the electronics industry and not necessarily say this is what's going to be in the Foxconn plant, but here are a few things that illustrate the complexity of just making these things and the complexity of doing it in an environmentally sound way.
And so as we wrap up, Scott, you said that part of this incentive package that is making its way through the legislature really reduces the kind of reporting they need to do in advance. Once the plant is up and running, assuming that it is, who would be in charge of making sure that Foxconn follows the environmental regulations that do apply to them?
Basically, the EPA and the DNR, you know, the DNR is charged with enforcing some federal regulations on the EPA's behalf. And of course, swirling around all this is all the recent concern about the DNR, you know, cutting staff and having its budget cut and whether it's going to have the capacity to do this well. I mean, there's already been concern about that in the context of existing environmental issues in the state. So certainly that conversation's not going to go away when it comes to Foxconn.
Well, Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Judith.
That was Scott Gordon, associate editor for wiscontext.org. You can find a link to his reporting on the environmental impacts of Foxconn over on the Central Time Facebook page. It's been an odd summer movie season. Typically, summer movies are big blockbusters like superhero movies or sequels of Pirates of the Caribbean. While we did have some superhero movies and one pirate sequel, we've also had more serious movies like the World War II movie Dunkirk. And there have been several movies with a social message like An Inconvenient Sequel.
Reggie Ponder, also known as Reggie the Real Critic, joins us now. He appears weekly on Vocalo in Chicago and critiques movies for a lot of other media outlets. Reggie, good to have you back.
Always good to be back, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Excellent. You know, it's been an interesting season for the summer.
Yeah.
What you probably know is that overall the box office has been down. I mean, it's been down about 12%, and there's some thoughts that by end of when they officially count all the ticket sales that they'll probably be down about 15%. So that's huge. And one of the questions I think that you talked about is how different this season is. But the first thing, Rob, that I want to talk about is how similar it is that we had Pirates, mm-hmm. we had Guardians, we had Spider-Man, we had Despicable Me, Cars 3, War for the Planet of the Apes, and Transformers. And those are all part of big franchises. So obviously what it's saying about the box office is that people are probably tired of seeing those same things over and over again.
Well, I want to get into some of the things that are a little different than your standard summer blockbuster, and one that I understand is one of your favorite. We're going to listen to a clip from the trailer, a documentary actually called Step. It came out earlier this month. Here's a listen to that trailer.
We're in Baltimore City. They come home to no lights, not having food in the refrigerator, not having a refrigerator at all. But when they come to step practice, all of those things are erased out of their mind, so they can make it through life.
Tell us, what is Step about, Reggie?
This documents the senior year of some girls at a high school in Baltimore that formed a step team in sixth grade. And it really shows them trying to graduate and what's going to happen for their future. But it's also against that whole backdrop of Freddie Gray and the inner city and how difficult the times were there. And this is such a heartwarming story to watch these girls. You are hooked from the beginning because you want to know what happens to them, and you're rooting for them. And you even see these adults who are trying to help them succeed. I love this movie. It's only playing at some select theaters, but I wish more people would go see it. It's fabulous, absolutely fabulous.
Now, there are a lot of, fictional movies that kind of follow this storyline, the group of kids in the inner city trying to make it doing this, dance thing or music or sports or whatever. But this is a documentary. And as you mentioned, it's going on amidst the background of Freddie Gray and the turmoil in Baltimore. What is it like seeing those two up against each other there?
It's tough, but I think that it sets the framework for showing how you can succeed against all odds and how there are a lot of good things happening in those communities. A lot of times what we see is that everything is tough, so nothing good can become of it. But here you see that everything is tough, and you see how beautiful these flowers become, and meaning the children who come out of this school and their possibilities. I just love it.
And is this going to be in wider release, do you think?
No, because it's a documentary, it is going to be in select theaters. They did do their widest release, I think, that they're going to have, and I just request that people look for it. Actually seek this film out and go check it out. I had an opportunity to see it with my family the second time around, and it was even better the second time. So hopefully people will go and check it out.
That's the documentary Step, and now a documentary, a sequel, but not to a big franchise, an Inconvenient sequel, the sequel to An Inconvenient Truth. Want to give a listen to the trailer here. This is being polite may not seem like a radical act. Being polite is something we've been taught as children and we work on for the most part for the remainder of our lives. And being polite may not be the first thing that comes to mind when we think about politics and the formation of the United States.
But our next guest says that being polite and acting civil marked a change from previous rulers and governments and was crucial to American democracy. In fact, he says the founders' move to be polite and civil was a radical act.
Stephen C. Bullock is a history professor for the Worcester Polytechnic Institute. He's the author of Tea Sets and Tyranny, The Politics of Politeness in Early America. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I don't always think of, the American Revolution as an example of politeness exactly, but you say that was actually a crucial distinction between the people rebelling and the government they were rebelling against. Can you spell it out for us?
Well, I think they were certainly thinking about it. It's not the case that everyone was always polite and all the leaders were as polite as they ought to be. As we know from reality, it doesn't work that way. But that's certainly the vision they had in their minds. They are thinking about politeness, as you said, not just a personal virtue, not just something which you do in your everyday life, in your personal experience, but also as a public virtue. So virtue, the virtue of politeness involved, being generous, being kind, being concerned about other people. And they thought that was a key toward creating a more democratic, a more responsive government.
And that's in contrast, of course, to most of the governments of, say, Europe, which were monarchies, often tyrannical, as seen especially from our shores here. Can you talk about the sort of behavior, the unrestrained, unpolite behavior that they were rebelling against?
There are certainly all sorts of examples of that, and it's really, England is in some ways a source of this. So it's not necessarily that English people are less polite or less are thinking about that less, but Americans certainly felt that, and they felt that, the experience of government, essentially to the beginning of time had been one of leaders trying to overawe people, trying to control people, trying to push them into things, and so they began to suggest that politeness was a way of responding to that and of making a better kind of world. The example that I use in an article I published in Aon that I think is on your website, of someone who was of that older kind of vision of things, is Governor Francis Nicholson, who's governor of Virginia. So in some ways, one of the centers of the revolution later on, one of the centers of this vision of politeness in the early part of the 18th century, this is a man who was sort of unrestrained in his bouts of anger and of rage, and he would go on and shout at people for hours upon hours. So, and I think he saw that as part of a way of thinking about how you should rule. He thought that it was the job of the leader to tell people what to do, and if they weren't listening, then he needed to shout louder and make sure they heard them, make sure that they heard him, and make sure they did it.
And a word you just used there I think was really important, unrestrained. The idea that if I am a person in power, whether I'm a monarch or the representative thereof as a governor in this case, my power means there are no restraints on my behavior. Is that a key part of the story?
Right. I think that's a very good point. The lack of the idea of restraint, of being responsive to other people, of being responsible, all of these things are part of what a polite leader would be. And the term which they used, and it's used in the all sorts of things from the American Revolution, the term that they liked to speak about was arbitrary government. That was something that they disliked intensely. And arbitrary government sort of means that the leader feels he has no or she has no restrictions on them, that legal issues, customs, public opinion, all of those are unimportant, that it's really the will of the leader which is the central idea. And politeness said, no, you need to have respect. You need to be moderate. You need to allow other people to have a say in things.
Talking to Steve Bullock, history professor, author of the book Tea Sets and Tyranny, The Politics of Politeness in Early America. And Steve, I want to hash out the word polite a little bit, because I think at that time, and even a little bit now, you might think of polite society. So I lift my pinky when I drink my tea and eat my crumpets and that kind of thing. We're talking about a different meaning of politeness. How did the founding fathers and mothers of American democracy think of this idea of politeness?
That's right. I think today it has the vision of being overly concerned with rules and those sort of things. So polite to us sometimes sort of means, you know, make sure you say thank you as you say goodbye to people and at the party and those kind of things. And those are important. But politeness originally meant something like smooth, polished. So up until right around 1700 or so, that term in English simply meant something that was smooth. So if you talked about a rock, it could be a polished rock.
Ah, okay.
And then it becomes something that they apply to people. So in a sense, a polite person is someone who's polished, not necessarily that they shine and they're so extraordinary and things, but they're polished so that they don't have rough edges, they don't have sharp sort of things sticking out when they're dealing with other people. They're able to interact positively and pleasantly with other people.
And as a counterpoint to the governor you were talking about, Nicholson, earlier, you talk about Thomas Jefferson as a key person in developing this idea of politeness as in part a political attitude in response to arbitrary government. Can you talk about Jefferson?
Well, he has this vision. I mean, his ideal is that being polite is a necessary part of things. He even says during the American Revolution, he says, you know, when we capture soldiers there, we need to treat them politely, which is kind of a extraordinary kind of thing, especially when we know that in reality, that by the end of the Revolution, captured people are often treated extremely harshly. And Jefferson uses the term politeness. He uses that term of being concerned for things, and so that's a big part of his experience. He is particularly impressed by Benjamin Franklin as an example of this. He says Franklin was the most polite sort of person in society, that is, in public gatherings he ever saw. So it's kind of an extraordinary thing, and he spent a lot of time with Franklin because they were in France together. In some ways, the center of personal politeness, at least, the place where people had thought about that and had shaped their personal actions more like that. Franklin was a sort of great example of that sort of thing. And we know from Franklin's autobiography that this is something he worked on early in his life. I think in some ways, his early part of his life, he was a little bit of a almost like a know-it-all, somebody who really wanted to argue with people. And he sort of, in his autobiography, writes about changing that and realizing that you can't contradict people all the time. You can't speak and hope that you're going to have a victory over people. You have to show concern for other people and be concerned about pleasing them.
So if you're in the mid-1700s on this band of colonies on the Atlantic, you're ruled by this often arbitrary government from across the sea, represented by governors who might scream at you for 6 hours if you looked at it the wrong way. Does this idea of civic politeness become, it seems weird now to think of it, does it become a radical thing to do?
Well, in some ways, I mean, it is a radical thing. It's true in England as well, because they're fighting against, you know, people who are harsh and want to control things. But Americans sort of, when you get to the Revolution, they see themselves as following through, as pushing forward that that deep sort of vision of things. They didn't like people telling them what to do. They didn't like this arbitrary, this absolute government, which seemed not to be concerned about how people are treated. And that's a theme today, right? In rap music, the term, I was dissed. I don't want to be dissed, and that comes from disrespected. And so I think it's very much part of the same kind of concerns. The 18th century, they didn't want to be dissed. They didn't want to be disrespected. They wanted to be treated generously. And at least in their better moments, the founders thought of themselves as acting properly in that same kind of way, showing respect for other people, showing concern about how people felt about them, and then if necessary, of course, trying to treat them better and trying to change their minds about things.
We're talking to Stephen Bullock right now about why American democracy can be at its best. It was kind of a founding idea, really, when people, especially in government, are polite. He's a professor of history at Worcester Polytechnic Institute.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What role do you think politeness plays in our political process? Do you think that politeness is missing from our political discourse? If so, what steps do you think we can take to help us become more civil and polite? Give us your thoughts by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave your comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the role politeness played in the shaping of our American democracy. We're talking to Stephen Bullock, history professor at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and he wrote a piece examining this history for Eon. You can find his piece linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about this idea of politeness being an important part of the founding of America, and what do you think, if any, are lessons for today? Do you have hopes that we can maybe get past some of the discord and agree to disagree politely in American politics? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Steve, politeness, I think people can think of as kind of a passive virtue and maybe a bad thing to have in some cases. You're not going to stand up in the face of injustice. Obviously, what you're talking about with politeness among the founding fathers is not that, because ultimately they had a revolution against arbitrary government.
Yeah, well, they weren't afraid of disagreeing if necessary, of course. But and when pushed, they were willing to, to respond, with full force there. But they also recognize that that within the community, within sort of everyday life, that there was a need for people showing respect for other people, that even though there was a disagreement, that the best way to handle that was not to turn your back on somebody, not to treat them harshly, but to show some respect and to be responsive to them. Now again, they didn't necessarily do it. They had as we know, the history of early America after the Revolution is a period of often harsh kind of political divisions.
I mean, these guys were real jerks to each other very often. I mean, a lot of the people we have on our pantheon of founding fathers, right?
They could be very harsh, and I think, and it's one of the lessons which I learned from reading this, is that both in the early 1700s and in the later 1700s, that when they're talking about politeness, they're not simply sort of thinking in sort of pie in the sky, sort of never never land sort of things. They're thinking about this because they know how bad people can act.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Matt calling us from Chicago. Matt, hi.
Hello, I love the topic and the things I'm hearing. I think it's wonderful. I've always thought that someone who can present a point, even a counterpoint, even a sharp one, in a polite manner, elevates the power and the stature of how they present it. So I think it's fantastic. I wonder if, and I missed it, the professor, the author, thinks that it also should should or could translate to the press. Obviously, there's a lot of press back in the times, you know, when the Ben Franklin and all those folks were around, and there was some plenty of sharp words in the press, a little easier to be, you know, on the printing press and be provocative. What do you think about the press adopting politeness, maybe even in the daily briefing room?
Matt, thanks for the call. Steve, some really interesting points to bring up there. First, can you talk about how the press back then in the days you're talking about fit into this concept of politeness?
That's a hard one. Let me first note Matt's very good point about, you know, that in some ways the politeness was not designed to make everybody think the same. It was designed in some ways so that you get better outcomes because people have more concern for each other and are more willing to share what they think and to interact with each other. So I think that's an important point. The press in America, you know, has had a tough it's a tough question. People write virtually from the very beginning, from Benjamin Franklin's brother, when he was an apprentice. Remember, Franklin was apprenticed to his brother. His brother runs a newspaper, which is often extremely harsh toward the leaders of Boston, and so there is that history, and it's gone on. And I think Franklin, when he gets his own newspaper, has decided that he needs to be careful about that. That he needs to protect his press and to protect the public discourse in some ways by being less, by attempting to sort of not push real hard on being harsh to people. Now, he has his moments later on, the 50s or 60s or so, when he's really angry with the Penns, the Penn family. He can be pretty harsh there. And of course, when the revolution comes, he is, you know, fully in the American camp. But, you know, he is thinking about that. But there's also, you know, the experience is such that politeness is not often there in a lot of the press.
Thanks a lot for that call, Matt. We're talking to Steve Bullock, history professor for the Worcester Polytechnic Institute, author of the book Tea Sets and Tyranny, The Politics of Politeness in Early America. We have a piece he wrote linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Back to your calls. Mark is on the line in Altoona. Mark, hi.
Yeah, they're saying the plural of anecdote is not data, but I don't know if the professor was in Wisconsin. I guess it was in the 90s when the national budget was going to $1 trillion. And people were saying, hey, well, you know, what's going on? Where's our money going? But at that time, the people who had come into power were like, there are guys doing life in jail because their daughters dreamed of kangaroos.
I'm not sure where you're going, Mark. What you told our producer, I thought was interesting, that, you know, at the time of the Vietnam War, some people wanted to protest politely, and then others thought it didn't work, came to violent protests. And there's always been this distinction, Steve, between angry, violent protest and politeness, seeing each other as too harsh or too naive on one side or the other. Your thoughts on that?
I think it's a continuing issue that, you know, that there's always the question about, you know, how much of a stand do you need to take? At what point do you need to go from, you know, letting people speak and showing respect there to standing up against things? And that's a very tough question. You know, I think Franklin faced that very issue when he is in France. He's one of the greatest diplomats we had. He helps bring France into the revolution. He keeps them on our side, allowing America to win the American Revolution. But John Adams, who was extremely brilliant man, later president of the United States, of course, he feels very upset. At Franklin, he says, you know, you aren't raising our issues. You aren't talking boldly enough. You aren't explaining clearly enough. And so he thinks that Franklin is being too nice about things. Now Franklin thinks, you know, no, I understand how these people operate, and it's better to act in this way.
As we wrap up, just in our last minute, Steve, you've been writing about the 18th century, but living in the 21st century. Are there lessons you think, or at least thought-provoking ideas that we can take from the founding of the United States when it comes to politeness?
Boy, you know, when I started writing this, I had no idea that, you know, that this would be a time when people were so desperately concerned about this issue. And I do take some hope in what I see back in the 18th century, particularly the beginning of the 18th century, when things were so when people were so angry, people were fighting with each other, angry all the time, and there are people, smart people, who said, you know, it's hard to imagine this is going to be resolved in decades, sort of thing. So, you know, so it's again, this does seem rather utopian, but in some ways, you know, it grew out of a time when people were just as worried about things as we are today, and in some cases, maybe more frustrated at things.
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Stephen C. Bullock. He's a history professor at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts. He joined us today to talk about the role politeness played in the formation of American democracy. You can read a piece that he wrote for Aon Magazine. We've got a link to that over at the Central Time Facebook page. Sequel to the documentary from some years back by former Vice President Al Gore.
The most criticized scene in the movie An Inconvenient Truth was showing that the combination of sea level rise and storm surge would flood the 9/11 memorial site. And people said, what a terrible exaggeration.
Hurricane Sandy slammed into New York City last night, flooding the World Trade Center site.
Storms get stronger and more destructive. Watch the water splash off the city. This is global warming.
So again, it's a movie that features a lot of Al Gore talking. What did you think of An Inconvenient Sequel?
So the first thing is that I was telling you how everything is so similar, and then we get another sequel here, and you say, well, do you need another one? But I think that clip actually shows why you do, is that the first movie said, look, this stuff is happening, and so much so that it's going to flood the World Trade Center. I mean, the World Trade Center. And people say, oh, no, that's not going to happen. And then, sure enough, it did. So it really shows that this stuff is real, that it's happening, and that we need to do something about it. Because they're obviously in our political climate today, you know, with the United States saying, hey, we're going to pull out of the France Accord. This was necessary now, so it's really interesting, the timing. It is necessary now not to lull people to sleep. And I think the thing that they do really well in this movie is that they show that while we've damaged the planet, that there's some things that we can do to make it better, to preserve what we have today, that there's a real energy revolution coming where wind and solar are so cheap. The biggest thing, I got to speak to of the directors, Bonnie and John, on this, and the biggest thing that I came away with is, and at least I asked them about, is how do they get poor people and minorities involved in this, because usually those are the folks that are most affected but come to the party late as it relates to doing something about it. And what they're doing is a major education campaign and making sure that kids and schools get to see this movie so that they can get young people involved in this effort early on.
Got a link to that interview on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to Reggie Ponder, also known as Reggie the Real Critic, looking at what's going on in the movie world this summer. Another movie that came out, a social message, this one out this month, Detroit, looking back at Detroit 1967, a big story within the riots that happened in Detroit and around the country. How is that movie?
So I really like this movie, but there's a number of things that make it controversial. First, a lot of folks don't want to see this movie. It is a true story of three young African-American men who were murdered at the Algiers Motel. And so you already know what's going to happen, but it is a hard movie to watch. I think they do an excellent job. But one of the controversies is around director Kathryn Bigelow. The question some people are asking is, can a director, a white director, really tell a black story from a black perspective? And from my perspective, I think that she did a really good job of making sure that it was about the black characters. It wasn't from a white perspective, and I think she did a good job there. So, but that's one of the things. It's tough to watch to see this because it is really cold-blooded murder. And but I think it's timely, and it does have a social message because it's really setting the stage to say or saying to people that this whole thing of policemen killing African-Americans is not new, and that's why this distrust lingers and lives on today.
Another movie that was difficult in some ways. I saw this one, Dunkirk, huge blockbuster. Not your lighthearted summer adventure fare, though. Dramatic movie about a key moment in World War II, but a big story of a retreat, basically, from what looks like certain doom. Are you recommending this one?
Oh, absolutely. This is so. Step is my favorite, and Dunkirk is right behind it. You saw this, right, Rob?
I did. Yeah.
What did you think?
It was amazing, very well done. I saw it with my family, in part because Harry Styles is in it. One of my daughters wanted to see that. We were on a summer vacation. It's not exactly your vacation mode movie, but a very powerful, and I'm very glad I saw it.
And what they do a lot of things well. And I don't talk a lot about the cinematography, but this looks fantastic on the big screen. And then they do another thing that I like is that there's not a lot of dialogue, but they get you to love to care about these soldiers, and I'm rooting for them every which way. When they try to get stowaway on a boat, when they're hiding on the beach, I'm just rooting for these guys. What a great job. For anyone who's interested, I'd say if you like a war movie, this is the war movie to go see.
And then finally, a movie that I understand has done fairly well at the box office, A Baby Driver, another one I've seen. This is... Well, there's definitely violence and strong language, but this was a blast.
Wasn't it? This is so. To me, this was that quirky, different kind of take on crime. And so you get this young guy who is forced to be a getaway driver for this crime syndicate, and he's stuck in that role. But then, how does he take back his power? What does he do to survive? I loved it, and the musical track for this one, the music, it really helped drive, and pun intended, the movie forward.
That's great. I've got to listen to the soundtrack more. Very briefly, Reggie, next movie, fall movie you're looking forward to?
So I'm totally looking forward to the new Star Wars movie. That's the one that everybody else is looking forward to. I'm looking forward to seeing that, and obviously I'll come back and talk to you guys about the new slate of fall movies, but that's the one that I'm looking forward to.
Looking forward to the movie and to talking to you. Reggie, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. You guys have a great evening.
We've been talking movies with Reggie Ponder, also known as Reggie the Real Critic.